3, 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we inform you about a deterrence topic and its value in preserving peace. We hope you enjoy this show.
Aloha and welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS Knowledge, an educational podcast by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. I am your host, Curtis McGiffin, and I'm the Vice President for Education here at NIDS, as well as a co-founder. And today we're going to dive into a topic central to international security and defense policy. We're going to introduce the differences between strategic and regional deterrence. This lesson presented is my own and was derived from my NIDS course, Intro to Global Nuclear Security, one of the many courses you can take here at the NIDS Academy online. Strategic and regional deterrence. These terms seem a bit technical, but by the end of this talk, you will clearly distinguish between them and understand their importance in today's complex world. So let's break it down. What is deterrence, and how does it differ between the strategic and regional scale? First off, deterrence is the strategy and effect of a deliberate effort or efforts to prevent an attack or a hostile action by threatening serious consequences, usually through fear of an intolerable response. It's not about fighting wars, it's about preventing them. Think of it as the threat that says, if you do this, the consequences will be too costly, and you might be destroyed in the process of an attack or in retaliation from your attack. There are two basic types of deterrence that we're going to encompass in today's lecture, and that is deterrence by punishment, which is if you attack us, we will strike back harder, and deterrence by denial. You can try, but you won't succeed. Now that we've got the foundation, let's zoom in on the two forms of deterrence, strategic and regional. Let's start with strategic deterrence. This typically refers to nation-state deterrence at the highest levels, often involving long-range intercontinental nuclear weapons. Strategic deterrence looks to dissuade potential adversaries from launching a strategic attack, particularly a nuclear attack, upon the U.S. homeland by threatening to impose intolerable retaliation costs. U.S. strategic deterrence is underwritten by a safe, secure, and effective nuclear arsenal and reinforced by a resilient sensor and nuclear command and control architecture. Consequently, it remains a top priority mission for the United States and requires adequate resourcing and political resolve to convey maximum credibility to the world. Strategic nuclear deterrence, which contributes to America's superpower status, relies on the credible threat of guaranteed and intolerable retaliation, supports the non-proliferation goals of extended deterrence, enables America's conventional military prowess, and empowers diplomatic sway. Strategic nuclear deterrence relies mostly on the state's credibility to function successfully. It's about deterring existential threats, those that could annihilate the nation or seriously disrupt global stability. Ironically, strategic nuclear deterrence is what prevented the Cold War from escalating into a hot conflict. Some key characteristics include its global scale. Think ICBMs, long-range bombers, and submarine-launched ballistic missiles, weapons that are greater than 5,500 kilometers. Next, it's about higher yield. Generally, strategic weapons are considered higher yield weapons, something greater than, say, 49 kilotons. Strategic nuclear weapons are intended to hold at risk or threaten the adversary's sources of military, economic, and political power, including military facilities, factories, and even cities, to inhibit the enemy's ability and will to wage war. Third, it's state-to-state focus, primarily between nuclear powers that can threaten a direct nuclear attack upon the United States, like Russia, China, and yes, even North Korea. And fourth, it's about high-level decision-making. National command authorities are involved. This includes presidents and prime ministers, supreme leaders and general secretaries of communist parties, as well as military chiefs. It is essential to recognize that America's nuclear arsenal is influenced not only by domestic political choices, but also by the constraints and definitions established by strategic arms control treaties. Generally, strategic nuclear forces are defined in America's standing arms control treaties, while all other nuclear weapons not defined and are thus designated as non-strategic nuclear weapons are often associated with regional deterrence measures. Now let's talk about regional deterrence. This shifts deterrence from a global scale to a more local or theater-specific threat. The emphasis here is on deterring aggression in specific regions. Consider the Korean Peninsula, the Baltic states, Central Europe, or the Middle East. Regional deterrence is often tailored to address particular actors, threats, or rivalries, and typically must consider diverse geographic and diplomatic challenges. Regional deterrence seeks to dissuade local powers from attacking U.S. interests within the given geographic region, or from deliberately escalating a localized conventional conflict into some form of nuclear conflict through fear of failure, increased escalation, or the threat of intolerable retaliation. This effort relies predominantly on the capability to function successfully. Regional deterrence is often focused on protecting allies and partners in a given region, addressing both nuclear and non-nuclear threats, may focus specifically on rogue states like North Korea, and often focus on keeping limited conventional conflicts from getting bigger, using immediate deterrence to preclude or manage escalation. Now, regional deterrence might involve a number of things, including forward deployed U.S. and allied forces, missile defense systems, rapid reaction forces, regular joint military exercises with allies, and yes, theater deployed, short-ranged, and lower yield nuclear weapons, including sea-based systems within the region. Regional deterrence is not particularly effective against most gray zone or hybrid warfare activities, espionage or sabotage, civil unrest or civil war within the borders of a country, or special operations or commando-like activities. Unlike strategic deterrence, which often operates in the background, regional deterrence should be highly visible. It focuses on presence, readiness, and practice. Consider U.S. troops in South Korea, NATO exercises in Eastern Europe, or missile defense systems in Israel. These activities demonstrate capability and commitment to allies and send a clear message to adversaries, we're ready and you won't win. So let's put the theory into context with a few real-world examples. For strategic deterrence, the U.S. effort to maintain and modernize its nuclear triad, its stockpile, and infrastructure to deter a first strike by Russia or China. That's its primary emphasis. For regional deterrence, thousands of U.S. troops in South Korea deterred North Korean aggression without using nuclear weapons. NATO's nuclear capacity in Europe to deter Russian adventurism, or even increased maritime forces in the Western Pacific Ocean to show force in and around the South China Sea. So while strategic deterrence focuses on preventing large-scale wars from starting, regional deterrence emphasizes maintaining stability in hotspots that could escalate into broader conflict. So there you have it. Strategic and regional deterrence, two sides of the same coin, each critical to national and global security. Both strategic and regional deterrence efforts are essential, serving different yet complementary purposes for averting war. Strategic nuclear deterrence addresses peace and stability directly between nuclear superpowers or those with the capability to directly threaten the U.S. homeland, while regional deterrence seeks to prevent smaller conflicts from escalating into larger wars. Understanding the distinction between strategic and regional deterrence enables us to recognize how nations balance power, avert conflict, and uphold peace, not solely through strength, but also through careful management of risk, perception, capability, and credibility. I thank you for listening to today's NIDS Knowledge, and I hope you learned something new and valuable about deterrence. Until next time, have a great day.
Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.
A production of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies.